Eh bien, je suis extrêmement ravi d'accueillir Thomas, ou Tommy pour les amis, Kirchhausen, qui nous joint de Boston, de Harvard. Tommy a fait son formation en biologie et biophysique au Pérou, au Venezuela et à Harvard. Alors, il a migré vers le nord. Et il est professeur à Harvard maintenant, à Harvard Medical School, de biologie cellulaire. Et lorsque je me promène dans son laboratoire, je vois toujours des murs qui sont remplis des images encadrées, des couvertures de Nature, Cell, Science, qui sont dérivées de ce travail. Et ces recherches, ces réalisations de recherche couvrent un grand répertoire de la biologie cellulaire à la biologie structurale, à la chimie génétique, et en particulier à l'imagerie, la microscopique par fluorescence des cellules vivantes et en molécules uniques. Et en particulier, lui et ses collaborateurs ont défini la structure de clathrine et des nombreuses protéines qui interagissent avec clathrine pour former les vésicules avec un manteau. Et avec l'aide de ces informations, ils ont réussi à donner une description des processus dynamiques et des événements mécanistiques sous-jacents à la formation des vésicules. Et Tom est constamment à la frontière de l'imagerie, de la microscopie, en développant des nouvelles méthodes, mais aussi étant toujours un de premières à adopter une nouvelle technologie et la pousser à ses limites jusqu'il a besoin d'une autre technologie. Et c'est là-bas en particulier avec sa collaboration avec Eric Betzig, le prix Nobel de chimie de 2014, sur la technique de la microscopie connue en anglais, lattice light sheet microscopy, que je suis sûr il nous expliquera un peu. Et quand je regarde la complexité de la microscopie aujourd'hui, je deviens un peu philosophique parce que il y a toujours un ensemble, un très grand ensemble de théories très complexes qui connectent la méthode et l'appareil avec les informations qu'on obtient avec cette méthode et l'appareil sur un certain sujet X. Alors, c'est un peu une frontière floue entre l'observation et l'inférence. Et ça me rappelle une phrase de regretté comédien américain Robin Williams qui disait « La réalité, quel concept !»
Thank you, Walter. It's very kind to have invited me here. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I've known Walter for some years. I knew Walter when he first came to Boston and for various levels. So we were neighbors first, where he was living. We're also neighbors professionally. He lives upstairs from my lab, a few floors. He's close to God, right? And so we have established a nice friendship over the years. And he asked me recently to join here and to share with you some of the things we're doing. So I don't know your background, so I wasn't very sure how to gauge what I was going to say. Since I don't know that, it would be great if you interrupt me as I'm talking. So if there's any question, anything to clarify or to engage, that would be, I think, nice. So I'm happy to do that. As he said, I work on clathrin. That's how I started as a postdoctoral fellow some time ago. I won't tell you how many years, however. And then as I was going through that, I went through a phase where we did molecular cloning. So I cloned clathrin. Then I was doing structural biology. So we got the crystal structure of clathrin. Then we did cryo-EM. So clathrin is the protein that self-assembles in a few seconds. It drives the invagination of a membrane. You make like a vesicle. You put things inside. That's cargo. That cargo, as I'm going to show you, can be a protein called transferrin, that's how you get iron into cells, but viruses enter this way. The bad cholesterol is how it enters into cells and gets destroyed. It's the most important way of communicating things from outside to inside of the cell, also moving things in. So that's what I was doing for a long time. And then came the problem that people were doing genetics to disturb the pathway. And this process is working so fast and with so many components that every time you would put a block, some new pathway will appear. So that freaked me out. So that's how we started to do what then was called chemical chemical genetics. So Stu Schreiber, Mark Kishner, Tim Mitchinson brought that notion to the medical school, and we created they created a space where small molecules were started to be investigated. So at the time, the pharmaceutical industry will have an enzyme and then do a screen against that enzyme on small molecules to find inhibitors. Our idea was to take a cell and affect the phenotype with a small compound. So we did the first phenotypic screens, and my lab, for example, for those of you that will be doing membrane traffic, discovered a protein that we call Dynasaur. There's a protein called Dynamin, I'll show you in a minute. It's involved in how clathrin coats work. And so we have an inhibitor for that, and we call it Dynasaur, Dyna for Dynamin and Saur for pain. So that was what triggered that, was to find ways to acutely interfere with movement inside the cell. But on doing that, then we said, well, how are we going to see this? So we started to do imaging, microscopy, fluorescence microscopy, already 20 years ago. And the way I've done this is by always looking to what my colleagues do and try to either collaborate or capture the technologies or ask them what they're doing to see whether we can incorporate that into our experiments. On doing this, through the years, we were the first people to follow in detail the dynamics of how I'm going to show you how these vesicles form. We started to track viruses in real time. So today we can see a virus moving inside the cell leading to infection. I won't show you that today, however. But what happened is that a few years ago, I met Eric Betzig. Met him at Janilia Research Campus. And the context in which I met him was a bit sad, because there was a guy, Gustafsson, Matt Gustafsson, who invented structural illumination. It's this trick by which you can do super resolution. He unfortunately passed away with a brain tumor, but there was a symposium that was organized in his honor, and I was part of that, and that's how I met Eric. So we became friends, and he introduced me to a new technology he was developing. This thing that you translated. No, you didn't translate, right? I don't know how you would translate this in French, the lattice light sheet microscope. Probably would be a horrid translation, so we'll call it lattice light sheet microscopy. And I'm going to show you a little bit of that, and then I'm going to show you a second generation, which is the same technology, but now instead of being able to look at cells, now we can look at the inside of cells with single molecule sensitivity in a tissue. In an organoid, which is sort of what you see here. This is inside the head of a zebrafish. I'll come back to that later. The detail is exquisite, and now we have buckets of information. We have now big data, and so in some ways this is a disaster, because now we have too much data, and I don't know what to do with that. So I want to do is share with you what we're doing, why we're excited right now, and give you a few bits and pieces. If you don't follow the biology, stop me, please. Tell me, hey, I don't get it, and I'll try to explain, and I'll just try to then go for that, okay? All right. So I'm going to give you two aspects in my presentation. One is connected to imaging sort of cells and organisms with what I refer to as molecular precision. These were studies that were originated by this guy, Goku Hoplayala. He went through ranks in my lab. He started with material sciences, and then he got promoted to assistant professor in our school, and then he just moved to Berkeley as an assistant professor. And then the second topic I want to mention is this thing that I call molecular histology. It's another trick that mixes this form of microscopy with a technique developed by Ed Boyden, which is called expansion microscopy. You will see in a minute what it means. Allows you to have images at very high resolution. I'm going to show you we can get images of a full brain of a fly with 70 nanometers, and we can get that in half a day. To put context, I think a few days ago, there was the news that Google released where they managed to follow the interactome of 1,000 neurons. It took them a few years of work to do by using EM. We did that with about 100,000 neurons in the data was collected in half a day. the processing took a little bit longer. So I'm going to show you that, okay? So I'm going to show you then this, and this Gokul was part of that, and there's a number of people here. In particular, Hui was the guy that developed the methodology that then was implemented by Gokul. And then there's lots of math, Vet and Dan were responsible for all the math I'm going to tell you. Okay, I'm going to first spend a couple of minutes just giving you the background, the optics of this, so we're all in the same level. So if you're using a standard optical microscope, you have, let's say, a piece of glass, and you have a cell, and typically you will illuminate your cell all the way through, and then you image in the focal plane, and there are different ways you can do that. One common way which biologists do this is using confocal microscopy, so you have a plane of interest, and that's where you image. And the problem of this form of imaging is that you have like a Gaussian-shaped beam, but illuminates the whole volume of the cell. So this is not really to scale. You're really illuminating, it's a very wide-shaped beam, and then you're illuminating and imaging, you know, some particular plane. Another way of imaging is something called TIRF. That means total internal reflection fluorescence microscopy. Very long name, just simply to say that you come with a beam of light that's coming, let's say, to the glass. And if you come at a very shallow angle, most of the light gets refracted. You then have an effect here where you create a standing wave, and the fluorescence is very high next to the glass and then decays exponentially as you go into the sample. So this decay is such that you can get good illumination in maybe a few hundred nanometers. So you can do single molecule imaging with very little background, very close to the glass. So that's very good if you want to see things happening on the plane close to the glass. It's a disaster if you want to look anything above, because this typically for a cell can be 10 microns. So it's black, you don't see anything. The third method, the one that Eric developed, is this lattice light sheet microscopy. You will see how it works in a minute. The idea is that you can make a very thin sheet of light. This beam, this sheet is represented here by the dotted lines. It's a cross section. So you have a plane that is coming to the wall. And then I can raster the plane through the sample. So let's say I can go from left to right. I could have an objective that is looking to this plane. So I'm now imaging the illumination in that plane. It's almost like if I'm doing TIRF, but now I'm inside the volume of the cell. It's also, you can think of it as an MRI. I'm doing now a 3D image. You'll see in a minute how that occurs, but that's the concept. The cool thing of this is that now I only illuminate that plane. I'm not bleaching anything outside of that plane, and the level of detail that I get here optically is very close to what I was getting in the TIRF. This, compared to the standard microscopy, where I'm still getting my focal plane, but I'm illuminating everything. So you can just imagine that if I'm collecting, let's say, 100 planes to get the whole volume of a cell, if I'm doing my confocal, I had to illuminate that cell 100 times to get my 100 planes. If I'm doing the lattice, I get my 100 planes of lattice, but the whole volume of illumination is only one cell. So I just gain a factor of 100. Okay, that's sort of the concept. So how this works? So in the normal form of microscopy, you have your objective. You illuminate with a disk of light in what's called the back aperture of the objective. The objective acts as a Fourier transformer, and then you get your beam that has this conical shape, is very focused in this spot, and then opens up again. So this, the tightest I can get is limited by the wavelength of light, and that spot typically, and this axis here is maybe 300 nanometers, that range, and this axis here can be maybe 400 or 500 nanometers. That's the standard microscope. I can illuminate with a disk of light, which is smaller than my back aperture, and that creates a bezel sheet. So what you see here is the cross-section of that bezel function that is going into the sample. If I would just do the cross-section of that, I get something like this. It's a little wider than this one here. And the property this has is I can go now in length for a long distance, and I can shape this in such a way that I can have constant illumination in some X length. The trick we're going to use is a modification of this. We're going to illuminate with a ring of light. So we're going to put a ring, and this ring, I can change the diameter of the ring, I can change the thickness of the ring, and that also will give me a transformation with the objective, and what I get is now a bezel beam. So it's still, I get a beam. I can change the length and the diameter by changing the width and the diameter of the back ring. but it's finer. But it has a problem, and the problem is if I show you the cross-section of this, it looks like this. So I have the central part, but I have now rings. So imagine that if I'm illuminating, I'll get also off-plane illumination. That's a disaster. So the trick now is I'm going to create many planes at the same time, and I'm going to do that by just taking that ring in the back, and I'm just going to modulate the light. So I'm just going to put a pattern, and if I put that pattern, I'm going to choose a particular pattern where I can have several beams, and I can just bring them together, depending just the frequency, the spatial frequency on that back ring. And what is interesting is because I'm using coherent light, there's this sweet spot where all the patterns that I get above and below the plane just vanish by destructive interference, and I only get the central part. If I now put a mirror and very quickly go back and forth, it's something called a Galvo mirror, so in 10 microseconds I'm just getting the scan, now I create a sheet. So now I have what I need. I have my sheet, now I can put my detector, which is a second lens, orthogonal to the plane I just generated, which is on cross-section here. That's a microscope. So that's the lattice light sheet microscope. So here you then have it. So all the optics is on the left side. We create the plane. We have an objective. I can either move this up and down and the objective with a piezo, or I can lock this and just move my sample up and down. That just depends on how I'm doing the experiment. And this is now what you get. So this is a cell that is expressing a fluorescent marker. It's at the cell surface. I just created my sheet, and now I'm going to scan through the sample, and I'm collecting now images, and I'm going to store it in my computer. So if I'm good enough on this, I can just get a plane every 5 milliseconds. And that, if I do this organized with the right fluorophores and with the light, the correct exposure, I can actually detect single molecules if I want. So and this allows me now to collect maybe in 1 second the whole volume of a cell, and now I can now follow dynamics. It's what you saw before, but I was doing that on a fish. I'll come later how we're doing that. That's the principle of the instrument. So this actually is one of the first experiments we did in lab. So we end up, with Eric's help, we ended up building a microscope that we moved to the lab. And this particular experiment was one that was a fellow at that time in my lab, Emma Kokuchi. He was interested in a biology that's referred to as exosomes. Really, that's not so important right now. But that was based on expressing a protein called CD9. This is a protein that transfers the membrane. We added to this GFP, so we can see it, and then we express it in the cell. So what you see here is a cell that is on glass. So the glass here is at the bottom. We're scanning, as I showed you before, and this particular movie was taken with 0.3 microns per step on distance, and this is like 150 planes on the stack that took 3 seconds to collect, and this is about 15,000 images, and this is a movie of about 7 minutes. I can assure you that if I would have done this with a microscope, a standard microscope, after maybe a few scans, everything is black, everything has been bleached. But this has not been processed. This is the raw data. And you can see there's basically no loss of signal. So from a biology perspective, now the surprises start to appear. So you see these things here that look like hairs. These happen to be called Filipodia. So I thought that Filipodia were things that cell has these tubes projecting on. I always thought they were in a cell and they were sort of going forward or backwards on the plane of the glass where you had it. That's that was my understanding. So I was shocked when we did this, and you can see there's like hairs all over the place. So if you would be interested in biology for this, now you can check, okay, how am I moving? Is it growing, contracting? Well, lots of things. Now, to put context here, the diameter of this thing is less than the diffraction limit of the microscope. So we don't really see the real diameter, we just see there's a source of light. But this is probably of the order of 150, 200 nanometers in diameter. That's below the resolution of the microscope. And yeah, that's how data looks like. Now you can imagine when I saw this, it transformed my life because we went back to other things we were doing in the lab, and we started to use this technology and surprises started to come. So the first thing I'm going to show you is going to be an animation, which is going to be running in background. It's an animation we did a few years ago. It's a molecular, I call it a molecular animation. It summarizes like 25 years of work from my lab and others, where we did crystal structures, cryo-EM, genetics, molecular interactions. So it basically puts everything we know on how you make a clathrin coat. So what you will see in the movie first will be a plane. There will be these guys here, which are proteins that are linking, proteins that are in the membrane, like this transferrin receptor, which is how you get the iron. And clathrin will come to this and will start to polymerize, and you will see these hexagons and pentagons building and forming the vesicle. The reason I'm going to show you this is two things. First, give you a sense of timing. The movie takes about the time it makes a real coated vesicle to form. And number two, because then we're going to put fluorescent markers into these proteins, and that's what I'm going to show you in the next slide, so you can see how we follow this by microscopy. So this is the surface of the cell seen from the inside here, and here's this is called the clathrin adapter. And now there are a couple of those that come, and that's the triskelion. And you see it's now locking, and it starts to self-assemble. So that process typically takes 30 to 40 seconds, and we'll see it here happening. And that's sort of summarized schematically here in the bottom. So we're seeing the process from the initiation until we make the coated pit. So you see it's now building, locking in place. If you're interested in discussing this later, we can also do that. I'm going to skip it right now because it's not so important for my talk. But we're going to put fluorescent dyes, the GFPs and the clathrins, so we can follow how it comes in. So the reason I'm going to show you this is because we can now track these events of endocytosis in the surface of a cell in three dimensions for a long time, and we can therefore get the biology of what's going on. So this is an example. So this is a cell. Each one of those spots corresponds to how we're tracking now one of those coated vesicles that is forming. The diameter of one of those spots is about 100 nanometers below the resolution of the microscope. The microscope is being done under conditions where we can quantify the fluorescence intensity. This is calibrated. So I can tell you how many molecules there are per unit time. And also I can tell you the position of these guys. These squiggles tells you where I'm in time. So I'm getting now lots of traces. So you get a sense of timing and the difficulty of the experiment. When we first did this, the very first time we did this was, I think the first experiment with this was 2002. And our first paper was published 2003. And we managed to follow 70 of these guys by hand. I mean, that was a lot of work. And we managed to track these guys and reach conclusions. This is a paper that came out a few years ago, 2016. And when we send this paper, I send it with 3,000 traces, because we are now follow everything in the surface of the cell. And the paper got rejected. So the reason why it got rejected, that was what the editors came back, is that in my lab, I should do more than 3,000. 3,000 wasn't enough. And they said that I should do 30,000 traces. So I don't know why 30,000 was an interesting number. So I went to group meeting and said, okay, guys, what shall we do? And everybody said their natural reaction was send a letter to the editor, right, and complain. So I asked them how long it will take you to do 250,000 traces. And they said a few days. So a few days later, we had 250,000 traces, and the paper was accepted in 1 hour. So that's the good news. The bad news is that you do the experiment today, you get your 250,000 traces, and then you repeat it the next day, and it's statistically different, right? Because now you have too much data. So my lesson here, I think there are people that are maybe doing experiments here in the lab, don't do too many experiments. I would just say an N of one, N of two. Okay, so this, for example, is the type of analysis we were doing at the time. So this shows fluorescence intensity in this axis. This is time. And so what we have done is now cluster this as cohorts. So this is the intensity of clathrin going up and down, or you can, if you wait a little longer, it can go a little bit higher and then down. So this is the growing phase, that's the encoding phase, and then we can divide them in groups, and we can start to analyze, you know, rates of polymerization and how many molecules come in, etc. At the time, the purpose of this was to see if there was a difference between the free surface of the cell, which is the top, from the bottom, and you see that the clusters look similar. So basically, for this particular cell, there wasn't really a profound difference. Anyway, that was the purpose of this experiment. But that's what we were doing with single cells, and we do many, many other things. We, I told you we can track viruses. So today we use optogenetics, so we can turn on, activate enzymes on command in the cell and allow an infection to happen or synchronize. So we can follow all those things now in a dynamic way. I'm going to skip all that because I want to go to another aspect of experiments I want to tell you. But I was mentioning transferrin, which is how you take cargo. So we can do the same experiment. Now we follow clathrin and transferrin with two different colors. Same idea. We have our cell. We track what goes in the top and bottom, and we get data out of this. This becomes relevant because on doing this, I can now tell you how many transferrin molecules are per coated vesicle. And so it turns out that it's stochastic, there are a few copies. So you can now start to connect the cell physiology with the actual sort of biology that you are getting here. But I want to go to something which is the next thing that we're excited is, can we do this cell biology? But can we do this cell biology now in a more complex environment? Many cells at the same time, that would be an organoid. Or can we do this in a natural environment that would be in a tissue of a living organism? So the answer is yes. So what Eric did is he went back to what the astronomers were doing. So if you're an astronomer and you want to study the stars and your telescope is in the ground and you look up to the sky, everything is very blurry and it's a fucking mess. It's a disaster. So what they have done is they have a laser, they shoot a beam, and this laser is called a guide star. You get a point source, which you image now in your microscope, in your telescope, and it goes through all the blurriness of the atmosphere, and then you see it back and it's all blurry. But if I have a mirror that is deformable in the path, I can actually correct that deformation. So because I have the knowledge that my spot, my laser beam was a spot, I have that ground truth. And therefore, I can readjust the shape of the mirrors, and there are different technologies to do that, so I can get back a spot. But on doing this, I just corrected the optical path of the microscope, so everything else in background gets sharp, and that's what's shown in the right. So you have the image with and without the correction, and that's what usually the astronomers get. So I'm now going to show you how we use that technology, how Eric put that technology to work in this microscope. And first, I'm going to show you this with an organoid. I'm going to come back to the clathrin world. Remember, these were point sources. So you will see first an image with no correction. It's going to be a blur. And then with the correction, it will be nice and spotted. And what I'm going to show you is the clathrin guys, which is the one that was making this geodesic dome type structure. And a second protein is called dynamin. It's the one that's going to the neck and is pinching the vesicle as it comes out. So I'm going to show you clathrin, which is the triskelion. I'm going to show you dynamin, which is the molecule that comes to the neck when this is ready to pinch. And so you cannot separate this physically by distance because it's below the resolution limit of the microscope. So they will co-localize, but you can separate them by time. So if I follow the clathrin, I get a tracing, and then this other guy comes as a spike at the end. But if I put this in an organoid, which would be cells embedded in, let's say, collagen, it's all blurry and I cannot see anything. But you will see what happens when we do the adaptive optics. So this is the, there are many cells here, and this is without the correction. It's a mess, you see nothing. But now let's correct. And now you see points. And now we have code that allows us to track every one of those guys, and that's what's shown here on the right. So suddenly, now we can do the analysis. We can track lifetimes, fluorescence intensity. We can now ask questions. So that's how basically the instrument works. If you're interested, I can go in more detail because it's a little more complex than just what I told you, but that's basically the principle. Okay, so let's go now to what happens if we go to an animal. Can we image animals? So the test we did was with zebrafish. There's a fish that is interesting because it's transparent. So it has certain mutations that makes it the animal transparent. And it's also convenient because you can have the egg. You can fertilize it in the lab, you wait for a few hours, and go through this developmental process. And it's always the same. So unless you screw up on activating the eggs, you always get back your animal. So the way we have been doing the experiments in collaboration with Sean Megason, who's a colleague of mine in the Department of Systems Biology, where also Walter is they have the eggs, and then we're expressing fluorescent proteins inside the animal, so we can look at different things. So I'm going to show you things in the tail and things in the head. The head is what you saw at the beginning. I'll come back to that. But I'm going to show you things in the head, and you will see in the tail, sorry. You will see clathrin again, but this time in the context of muscle. Then I'm going to show you in the head I'll specifically show you that first movie. These are neutrophils that are migrating. I'm also going to show you brain development here. Okay? So these are the two extremes I'm going to show you. Also, I'm going to show you development in the eye and how we have used this to study different things. And these animals start to develop muscle, so you need to immobilize them. So we don't use anesthetics, we use Botox. So some of us use Botox. You know what is Botox? You know that? Why are you laughing? I'm just kidding, sorry. Okay, Botox is a way to block neurotransmission, as you know. And so what we do is we just provide this to the fish, so the fish are frozen. They don't move, but it's not toxic to the animals, so eventually it washes out and they can continue alive. So we prefer that to anesthetic, so that way we don't interfere with the biology of the animal. Okay, so we're going to put our fish, and we can choose the developmental stage we want. We made special caps, special holders, that fits in the geometry that we have. We have a few millimeters of space between the objectives. The fertilized fish in the first hours is less than a millimeter, so it fits. And then we can then choose wherever we want to scan an image. Okay, so I'm going to first show you an image that was taken in the sort of in this region, in the tail. This is with a marker that goes to the surface of the cell, so just plasma membrane. This is static. As a reference, that's the cell I showed you at the beginning with the 300,000 coated pits. And you can just scale it, okay? But I'm going to show you that the level of detail that we have here is the same as this one here. And so the way we did this is we had to image in small volumes. You may notice that there are these sort of lines going along this axis, along that axis. These are small stacks that we had. It's stacks equivalent to what we were using to image this. For this particular experiment, we have like 129 of those stacks. So what we did is we collected the whole volume, and then we did the adaptive optics for each one of those stacks. We got what was the right correction. That takes about a minute, and then it's locked, and then you can collect sequentially in everything here. So if I would have used a normal microscope, maybe I would have had the level, and the E-beam was, let's say, coming from the top. Maybe I would have been able to get that level of data here, but then all the bottom is gone. You don't see it. It started to bleach, it's a mess. So this is how we can recover data. Okay, so the first experiment I'm going to show you is something that we were doing in the past in the lab, which has to do with cell division. So I don't know what's your background in cell biology, so I apologize if I'm going to tell you boring things. But so if you have a cell, there's an interface, it's like a pancake, and it goes into cell division, becomes like a sphere, and then you have the two daughter cells that divide, and then these cells eventually will grow and come back, each one to the interface cell. And for a long time, we were interested in trying to understand whether what happened to the volume through this process of the cells and also to the surface area. That was very, very hard to do without imaging. So what we ended up doing was putting a marker for the cell surface and then just using this microscope to get a surface area measurement of a cell as it divides. This microscope allows you to do that in the same cell because it's not toxic to the cells. The cells, if they get too much light, they stall. They go into DNA damage and they lock. But because we're not illuminating the whole cell and only the plane that we're interested, now the cells survive and we can go through. So the first thing I'm going to show you is images of a single cell and then cells in the eye of the fish on how we follow this. And the message that came from those experiments is that you have a cell that is an interface. We knew that cells were doing endocytosis through the clathrin pathway. They were going in, and then there were vesicles inside that were coming back to the cell surface. So the whole system was under homeostasis. So it didn't shrink, it didn't contract, or it didn't expand. But when it went to cell division, we found that the recycling stopped, but endocytosis continued. So the machinery was still taking things inside, so when you go to the sphere, the extra membrane that you have had here is actually absorbed into the cell, into lots of vesicles. And when you go to cytokinesis, these vesicles very rapidly are exported back to the cell surface. So people didn't know that before this experiment. People thought that the membrane was corrugated and then it was snapped, and bits of membrane were just being shitted or thrown out into the outside of the cell. But that's not the case. It's just simply a process of trafficking control. And I won't go into all the experiments we did to find what proteins are regulating these, what are the GDPases. I mean, I don't want to do that now. If you're interested, we can discuss. Just the process, that's the phenomenon that we got. Okay, that's a single cell dividing. And you can see that as the cell divides, it starts to bleb and divides. In fact, we found this blebbing, and I went to my colleagues to find out, have you ever seen cells blebbing in tissue culture? And they said, yes. I said, what do you mean? What does that mean? I said, well, your cells are dying. And cells are blebbing in cultures because they go into apoptosis. I said, but that's curious, because I'm finding all my cells blebbing, and then they finish dividing. So that had been missed. So it turns out that every cell that divides, it doesn't matter what cell you look, when it goes into anaphase, telophase, it's blebbing. This blebbing is all the membranes that are coming back very quickly as you divide. And what is plotted here is the volume, which is constant, and the surface area that started here drops and then comes back as you go through cell division. So this is the analysis for one cell. So then we did that on a tissue that is very active in cell division in the fish, and that's in the eye. So that's the eye of the fish. And then we wrote code to identify cells that were dividing. And so we found a few dividing cells. And you can see they're also blebbing and dividing. And there are now a few examples. And you see this is time. This is the volume. It's constant. And then you also can see how, from mitosis, they go up. Okay. So we you could say, well, is that really interesting because we repeated in the fish what we were having in culture? I would argue, yes, it's interesting because we didn't know that in culture we were having what was going on in the tissue. So maybe it's a circular argument, but anyway, that's what we did. Okay, now we go a little more complex. Let's go back, and in this case, we're going to be looking at the brain. It's another tissue that's very active in cell division. And now we're going to put several markers, not only the surface marker, now also organelles. Mitochondria, the Golgi apparatus. So first, you image the whole volume is a real mess. So Goku developed this trick where he could separate virtually one cell from the other. So we just map, we do water shedding, basically to find the outline of the cells. Then we virtually separate the cells, and then now we can track it in time. And we can choose what cell to look. This is just a way to help us identify the cell of interest. So on this, now I'm going to choose one cell, and then we're going to follow it in time, and you will see not only what happens in terms of size dimensions, which I showed you before, but the other interesting part is what happens to the organelles. Turns out the organelles are changing position as the cell is dividing. Presumably, this has to do with the cell physiology, the status of the cell. So I'm going to select that cell, and now we're going to track it in time. So we're going to have this cell here, and we're going to track the Golgi apparatus, the mitochondria, and the endoplasmic reticulum as a function of time when the cell divides, and the data is presented here on the top. So this path here that just shows the relative position of the organelles for this particular cell as we're moving in time during cell division. And turns out, for example, that when the cell divides, it puts the mitochondria into the periphery. Why that is, I don't know. We found that, and if you now start to look at other mitotic cells, you always find the same. The ER, for example, gets transformed from tubes to sheets, and then that sheets is important because that's how you recreate the nuclear envelope when you go after cell division and so forth. And then what was shown here was, again, the volume of that cell. You see we're having a surface area. It dipped and went up. That dip was in mitosis. Okay, so now I'm going to go to another type of problem, is can we follow other aspects of dynamics? Because right now, I was hinting on the organelles, so we can do that. Can I go in more detail? So I'm going to show you one example, and that example will be on clathrin. So this is muscle, and the green spots is going to be the clathrin, the red is going to be the plasma membrane, and what we're looking at is a bundle of muscles here. It was very hard to see this as a bundle, so we use the same trick that Gokul introduced. We virtually separate the myotubes. So this is a single time point, but now this is an image in 3D, live animal. So this is first to orient ourselves. So each one of those spots is one of those clathrin coated pits that I show you in the single cell in a piece of glass. Now you're seeing this in the actual organism. So there are spots that are in the surface, and this is endocytosis from the plasma membrane. Turns out that there are also spots in the secretory pathway, which is inside the cell, that will become apparent here in the central part. So we wrote code to separate topologically what was in the surface from inside, and then we can now follow the kinetics of this, and that now will show up here. So this, we have this image, we have now the single spots, and now we can repeat our tracking. So if you would be a biologist, you ask, well, what's the difference between muscle and brain? And there are various reasons why that's interesting, and the answer is there are differences. Oops, sorry, there are differences, excuse me. Sorry for this. So there are going to be differences. So it turns out that the coats that are in the muscle are longer lived and larger than the brain that are smaller and shorter lived. We think that's related because the clathrins in the brain are working to form the membrane recycling for neuron transmission. So that has to go very, very quick and very fast. I think we still need to test this experimentally. We haven't had a chance to do that. The experiments I'm showing you was with a prototype of a microscope that we were working on this for the last few years. And finally, a new design has been in place. We finished implementing it at Genelia, and we just brought it to my lab. We're just rebuilding. So soon we'll be able to repeat experiments. So anyhow, I'm sorry that I missed that slide. So, so you will see again the patterns, and then I'll continue. So we have the trackings that will show up here. And then with these trackings, we can then extract information. Now, that might be a bit boring for people, but I need to stress that it was impossible to do any specific cell biology with this level of detail in a cluster of cells in the past. And this is the first time now that it's possible to do in a cluster and in tissues. So here's the difference, for example, between what happens in brain. So you see they are shorter compared to the muscle, okay? All right, so I'm going to go back to that first movie I showed you. That movie is interesting to us because it shows, it was originally designed to look at the development of the inner ear, but it turns out to be very rich tissue because there's lots of migrations, self-movements, cell divisions, and in particular the movement of neutrophils, which I'm going to show you next. So to orient yourself, this is the skin, the outside of the animal. This is the brain. There's a capillary here, and there are cells that are moving through. You cannot see them because they're just going very fast. And there's stuff going in this space here. The blue spots is we took a sugar called dextran. We made it fluorescent. We injected it to the heart of the animal, and that was taken by endocytosis by like this type of cells, and they accumulated in a structure called endosomes, which are small vesicles inside the cell. So that allows us to map aspects of membrane traffic. The key for this movie is that you have now these neutrophils that are coming, and they were first close to the brain, and now they're walking through. You see that you have this guy here. For example, this didn't take the dextran, but that one had taken the dextran. Now, I'm not going to any deep analysis right now because we haven't had yet the ability to really extract information. But the level of detail that we have here is higher than any other form of microscopy. Fluorescence microscopy has been done in the past. So we can see all the convolutions of the cell. We can watch when it's migrating. We have measured the speeds of these things. That's okay. We found that these neutrophils have tails. We didn't know that neutrophils had tails. There's a scientist here at the Pasteur, Chiara. Chiara is working on something called nanotubes, things that she thinks are communicating cells between each other. It's a long elongations. We have them here. So in this space here, there are tubes that are coming out, and they're just expanding from one cell to the other. So I think these are nanotubes. We haven't experimentally proven that. I think these are nanotubes that are being used during development in the animal to maybe transmit signals, communicate between cells. I'm not sure. There's other biology that we picked up here, for example, in these endothelial cells. I won't have time to show you a movie. We can check cell division and, again, connection between cells, sort of lots of interesting things. If you're interested, you can go to this site. You can take a picture if you want. And if you go and you do that and you use your phone, you will get a 3D virtual representation of what I just showed you. It's going to be for muscle, and you can then move around your phone, and you get the, well, it's a toy, but it will give you a sense, a sort of more human sense of what I'm trying to do. I cannot represent this in 3D right now. Okay, this is development in brain. So this is something called the rainbow fish. So stochastically, neurons have been labeled with different colors. This is genetically labeled. So it's the labeling is at low density, so you can separate the neurons, you're not mixed up. So this is an animal that was about 15 hours post-development, and the movie lasts 15 hours. Okay, so we're imaging every minute for 15 hours and then gluing everything together. And the purpose of this movie is to show now this thing here, and that's innervation. So what you have is the axons that are just walking, and you have the growth cones here at the end, and they're making contacts. So if this is your field, you can go back to the static images that you had and map this to the dynamics, and actually maps quite nicely. But now you can get what are the contacts and retractions, and well, you can imagine the amount of information you can get here. You can get whether stochastic, non-stochastic, you know, patterns of behavior, etc. Okay, and the last thing I'm going to now touch is expansion microscopy. So Ed and other people developed an interesting trick to help us deal with something called the problem of low resolution in microscopy. So Betsy got his prize by figuring out that if you map the centroid position of two fluorophores, and you can go beyond the resolution of the instrument you're using. So in other words, if you get the centroid position of a fluorophore, and you get the central precision of a second fluorophore, that precision of the measurement breaks down the resolution limit of your instrument. So if the optical resolution of my optical microscope is, let's say, 300-400 nanometers, if I get enough counts to get the positional information, I can go down to 10 nanometers, 20 nanometers. So that's why he got the Nobel Prize, and also the STED microscope is the same logic. Okay? But that's very difficult to do as an experiment. I mean, it's doable, but then the optics for this is okay if I'm very close to the glass where I don't have deformations, I don't have anomalies, I don't have aberrations. Trying to do that beyond that is a real mess. So this expansion microscopy was evolved for various reasons, but there's an application now that allows you to super resolve the images. So how does that work? Imagine I have a sample, biological sample. I'm going to chemically fix the sample. The same way, if I'm doing my standard immunofluorescence, I just put a chemical like formaldehyde, and I just lock my sample. I just kill myself, I just locked. And that's how I normally do my fluorescence microscopy. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a dye, a fluorescent dye in the sample. It could be the GFP that I used before, or it could be an antibody that has chemically linked to it a dye. So anyhow, let's think it with the antibody. It's the simplest way to think about this. I have my antibody that is just mapping and labeling, let's say, this space here. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to cross-link the protein of the antibody that has the dye on it to a polymer that I'm going to add to my sample, like acrylamide polymers or some similar type of polymer. So I'm just going to have my fixed sample. I'm going to add a polymer. It's now like a sponge. Now I'm going to chemically cross-link all my proteins, including the antibody, to this sponge. Everything is locked. Now I'm going to come with a protease and chop it. And I'll do gently chopping such that stochastically I'll manage to get a peptide that had the fluorophore attached still to the polymer. So far with me? Yes? So I'm having my sample. I chemically locked it. I add a polymer. Now I'm going to chemically cross-link my fixed sample to the polymer. It's locked. Now I'm going to chop it gently. At this point, I'm going to simply take my polymer and expand it. I'm going to put it in water. The polymer expands isotropically in three dimensions. So if I have two spots that were here, isotropically I'm going to separate the two spots. And if the expansion is, let's say, five-fold, two guys that were, let's say, 100 nanometers apart now become 500 nanometers apart. I just super resolve. Simple, right? So let's see whether that works. So I'm going to jump through all the controls and all the experiments and just go directly to a sample that comes from brain and how we use that. So I'm going to show you as an example, I'm going to show you a slice that is depicted here in blue. This comes from a mouse brain that was just an embryo. So it's a teeny slice. That slice was about 2 millimeters in length by 0.3 by 0.25 in cross section. It had been fixed. It had been stained it had GFP, but also I'll show you stained with antibodies. And we're going to put it in the microscope and we're going to expand it fourfold. So the actual piece is 7 by 1 by 1 millimeters. Then I'm going to use the microscope and I'm going to do the stacks I showed you before. For this particular sample, turns out that we're going to stack about 18,000 times. That takes half a day for 3 colors. Then I have to glue everything together. That takes a weekend with a cluster of 3,000 CPUs. So you have to match everything back. And I'm going to now take this thing here and I'm going to show you a small area here so you can get a sense of what you see. And so here you have the axons in yellow. In the spots here is 2 antibodies that are marking what's the pre-synapse and the post-synapse. If I would not have expanded, they come on top of each other. I am not super resolving. But if I'm expanding, I can see in one case it's a disk, in another case it's like a sheet. That tells me that a synapse got established. So now the way to think about it, I have an axon, I have a dendrite, so let's say my arm. I have these spines, which is where I'm going to connect, and this connects with another dendrite. The junction, which is the synaptic connection, has in one side of the cell Bazun, and the other side of the cell has Homer, and that's what's shown here. So this is now lots of these guys, and we were able to map them, and you can trace them. So for example, out of this, we discover that neurons are making a lot of self-connections. Okay? So that's an example of data that you can get. This is another example of data you can get if you're interested in pattern recognition. So this is the cell body of a neuron. This is the GFP in the cytosol, and you see that these holes. So these holes are now where the organelles are located because the marker was cytosolic. It's not inside the organelles. So if you have a mitochondria, one of those will be a mitochondria. One of those might be the Golgi apparatus, et cetera. Right now, it's very hard to know what is what. So we can stain this with the antibody against mitochondria or something else. And that's here. So we can stain it with other markers. And so if we do that, for example, we put a mitochondria marker and a lysosomal marker. And it turns out that the holes match very well uniquely to what it is. So you have a type of hole that becomes yellow, and that was a lysosomal marker. Or you have another type of structures, which are, let's say, the purple guys, and that has to be a mitochondrial marker. So right now, we can use an antibody to map what will be the structure. But it would be cool, I think, to use some technique, machine learning, deep learning, I don't know, that I don't have to do the staining anymore. I just have to do the GFP labeling. I can map what organelle it is. Why I'm saying this? Because then you can imagine taking a sample, control disease state, and now you can start to explore what I'm referring to as molecular histology. Just to give you a sense, the doctors today, when they do the histology, they see where is the nucleus in one color and a blur where is the cell. So now we're looking at exquisite detail inside the cell. And this is my last movie. That's now the brain of a fly. Same technique. And now you see everything there. Everything has been mapped. I mean, it creates maybe a little vertigo here. But that's how the data looks like. And now the task is how to extract information, right? Because, yes, it's cool to see this, but what does that mean? So this is the Interactome project. And you know, you can use this type of information to maybe connect the connectivity with a behavior, development, etc. The challenge right now, I think, is not how to collect the data anymore. I think that has been solved. It took us 5 years of work to do this. So now I think the next thing is, what do we do with the data? I mean, how computationally we can capture this, analyze the data, classify, get clusters, commonalities, and things like that. Okay, so today I show you a subset of examples that come from my lab, where we're now having the ability to do things with high precision. So if it's in real time, we can get the centroids and map it down to 30 nanometers. If we do the super resolution, we can map actually positions to 70. And the temporal resolution I wrote here, 20, we're down to 5 milliseconds already. And this went black. Yes. And then, so now, this is the adaptive optics that I just described. So I had two lattices in the lab. I had one, and then I got a second one. Then I put number two in eBay a couple of years ago with that money. Now we're building this guy here. Now it has the mosaic. It has the name of Mosaic. In my lab, we call this microscope the thing, because we don't know. Well, it's the thing, Mosaic. Okay, this is just being deployed right now. So these are different things we would like to do, like dynamics and multicellular organisms. Maybe try to do some sort of an atlas of cell states. And this maybe is more connected to this audience. This is our problem. How do we now process data? Yeah, machine learning, deep learning, some other tricks. I mean, we have big data. How do we pull this out? What shall we do with that? So what I show you today was driven a lot by Gokul. He was involved in the adaptive optics experiments. The zebrafish started as a collaboration with Sean Megason's group, particularly with Ian and Kishore. And Sung Lee was the guy that helped collect the data for the fish I show you. And the expansion I mentioned is a collaboration with Ed's group and Eric's group, particularly Rui, which was key. And finally, my funding comes from NIH, Biogen, Ionis, and a little bit of HHMI. And I'm just going to finish with one last thing, which is just to show you things that we're doing in the lab. So we do things in endocytosis, so which I mentioned. I didn't give you any data on virology, but we use this form of microscopy. We follow other organelles, like, for example, endosomes. And cell division, I told you about adaptive optics, and this is expansion stuff. And with this, I want to thank you very much for your attention. I do something I normally don't do, but if you know anybody, especially for this, it will be cool, because we're desperate for people that can help us. Thank you so much.